Welcome back into the Mental Game, where this week's guest is tennis star Jeannie Bouchard.
I was going through a really tough time and I couldn't talk about it, or else I'd be labeled like weak or like failure. I just didn't want to like tie every single tennis match result to like my soul and my identity.
And in this episode, Jeannie opens up about living her dream in tennis, making it all the way to the Wimbledon final at just 20 years old, ranking number 5 in the world. But she also talks about struggling with that loss and her mental health, injuries throughout her career, the ups and downs in tennis, both on and off the court, all of that and much, much more in this episode. But first, I want to tell you about Man Therapy. And guys, I am talking to you. We have to talk about our feelings. We have to be vulnerable and take care of our mental health. And that's why you need to go to mantherapy.org to find amazing tools and resources to help us with our mental health. But now it is time for the latest episode here on The Mental Game with Jeannie Bouchard. Welcome back into The Mental Game. And as you can see, I got a very special guest sitting next to me, tennis star, now pickleball star, Jeannie Bouchard. Thank you so much for coming on The Mental Game.
Thank you for having me.
I just learned while we were talking before, pickle, that's how you say, like, that's how the community calls pickleball?
Yeah. Yeah, we just like pickle.
I've never played still. Like all my friends have played. And so I'm going to ask you about that in a little bit. But thank you so much for coming on. I'm really excited to talk about your tennis career. You know, this is dream of yours since you were 9 years old. You know, you got the top 5 in the world. You've dealt with some injuries, some mental health things. But I'm just so thankful that you're here to talk with us today. First thing I ask everyone when we come on The Mental Game is, what does mental health mean to you? And it's a very unique question to answer because it's personal to each and every one of us. Sometimes there's something that happened in our life that maybe sparked us to make some change, but I'll ask you the same thing. What does mental health mean to you?
Well, I think it's just so important to be aware of that. And like we were talking about earlier, nowadays, it's something that we can talk about so much more openly. And I know we'll get into that. But, you know, as an athlete, I'm so used to taking care of my physical body. Mm-hmm. And in recent years, everyone being more open about mental health, I've become more aware myself of just how I feel mentally. And I think the biggest, maybe the first word that comes to mind for me is stability. I really think feeling like stable in my head is when I know, like, mental health wise, I'm in a good spot.
Yep.
And not all over the place emotionally or scattered thoughts or things like that. So that's like where I know, okay, like peace, happiness, but you're not happy all the time. So that part's fine too, is like, as long as you have like even amounts of like happiness and sadness and mm-hmm. things like that, but just more being like somewhat stable and in control.
Well, I use this analogy all the time of like, if you break your leg, like you're playing tennis, you hurt your leg, you go to the doctor, you get a cast, you start rehabbing. If you do something with it, like if you're sad, you're upset, you should do the same thing. Like you wouldn't just walk around with like your leg dragging across the court mm-hmm. and not go get help, which I think that's been the cool thing, is seeing people think about it the same way. Have you seen that kind of change recently too?
Oh yeah, so much more. I mean, back in the day, like you didn't even want to admit that you had a sports psychologist. And so nowadays it's like, not only should you have one, if you don't have one, it's weird.
Right.
And if you do, like how often are you talking to them? Are you talking to them twice a week? Because if it's not, that's not enough, you know? So the pendulum has kind of gone a lot the other way, which I think has made people just feel more like seen maybe mm-hmm. and accepted. If they've felt like they've had issues, then it's like, okay, I'm not the only weird one. Like I feel like that relatability really helps people a lot.
I'd rather be weird than normal. So
I say that all the time. I say I'd rather be weird than boring. So you know what? I'll take it.
All right, cool. Two weirdos just talking about mental health. And your tennis career, you've got to the top. You suffered some injuries a few years back and, you know, getting back playing on the court now. But walk me back to that dream that you had when you were 9 years old. I've heard you say this before. You don't recommend picking your passion that early or picking your career. I kind of was in the same timeline with like wanting to be a sports reporter, but how did you just find that spark for tennis so young?
Yeah, well, I it's interesting because I think there's a lot of like intrinsic. It comes a lot from inside because I have a twin sister mm-hmm. and my parents, my mom put us both in tennis lessons at age 5. And I say this story where it was really like games. It was like bouncing balloons, jumping in hoops, like not really tennis stuff. And we only hit balls for 10 minutes at the end. And all the kids loved it because it's like games. And then I would like storm off the court crying to my parents and being like, we only hit tennis balls for 10 minutes at the end. I want to play more. And then they were like, okay, she's weird.
Yeah.
Everyone else is like a normal kid. And then we have the weird kid. And so I asked to play more. They put me in like private lessons, group lessons. I played my first tournament at age 8. And then age 9 is when I qualified for a 12 and under tournament, which is a big deal when you're 9. Because especially at that age, like the age difference, the physical difference is so big. Mm-hmm. And that's when I was like, I can travel, which I love, which I realized I love. I went to France and then I can play tennis and this can be my job. And I just like knew I wanted to be a professional tennis player and there was like no other option.
That is so cool to like have that discovery and to go after it. And then it just work right away. I mean, I'm sure you have to consider yourself lucky, but you also put in the work. Like you had differences than other kids and they thought it was a game at gym class or whatever at school. Yeah. This is what you were doing each and every day. How many hours did you spend playing tennis a day as a kid?
Yeah, this is the side that no one really knows about, the sacrifice. Mm-hmm. My twin sister, for example, retired at age 6, as I like to say, and went on to be a more normal, probably well-rounded, probably much better socially than I am. Because as I joke, I say I was chained to a tennis court for 20 years. But you really have to put the hours in. There's no magic pill. There's no, you know, secret formula. It's really just like, before school, my mom's like driving me to practice, after school, picking me up early, driving me to another practice. Then it's like homework, dinner, bed, do it all over again. And that's when you're actually at home. And then besides that, we're traveling not only like to the US for tournaments, I'm from Montreal, but around the world. Like we're like mini professionals by age like 12. It's really insane.
Do you remember the first big win you had as a, I guess you're still an amateur or semi-professional then.
Yeah, amateur. Yep.
Okay. What was your first big win?
I remember winning an ITF event when I was 14. So that's 18 and under. Mm-hmm. And so it was a low level one, but still to beat girls that were older than me. And it was an international tournament in Costa Rica.
That was super cool.
I was like, okay, like this is a good like step, you know? Yeah. And I turned pro when I was 15. Like tennis is a really young sport. And so at that age, I was doing full-time tennis and full-time school because I have to finish high school.
Right.
So it felt like two full-time jobs. And I was looking at my friends who can like barely pass just school. And I'm like in Europe for 2 months with my science books and my math books. And I'm like trying to keep up and I'm doing makeup tests when I get back. And it was really like crazy at that age until I turned 18 and finally graduated.
And obviously super excited to make tennis your full-time thing. Mm-hmm. I mean, you already were while you're trying to balance high school too, but I mean, you had a quick rise right after that. As soon as you went amateur to pro, you said 15 you turned pro. I mean, it took how long to start getting, you know, seeing yourself kind of climbing the rankings, competing more, not just being there, but actually like making yourself a mainstay?
Yeah. So, I mean, technically I turned pro at 15, but I still played junior tournaments as well until 18. And that's when I won Junior Wimbledon at 18.
Yeah.
And that's when I really felt a lot of confidence from that win and I transitioned very quickly into the pros. And so by 2 years later, I was in the finals of the main event of real Wimbledon. And I remember hearing about these statistics and I would have been like the fastest like junior winner to pro winner if I had won the title. And that's because I did play juniors late. I played till 18, but I think that helped me, you know, it made me deal with pressure of playing girls younger than me. So I was playing 15-year-olds and 16-year-olds that I had to beat. And that made me like learn to deal with pressure. And then suddenly I'm in the pros and I'm like, wow, this no way less pressure now. And I feel like I just played really well right away.
You bring up a good point because you would think like, obviously you have the edge as a younger girl playing girls older than you. You want to beat them. It's like kind of the upset. Now you have to be on edge and like you kind of have the target on your back.
Totally.
How did that kind of change mentally your mindset? And I want to get to, you know, the Wimbledon final here in a little bit, but how did that change like, going from, I mean, you were a kid when you turned pro. You're still playing amateur till you're 18. But like, I mean, I'll be honest. I don't think you really grew up until, I'm 30 and I'm still trying to figure it out. Yeah. But like the 21 to 25, I think you're still really young, still really growing. But those first 2 years, how hard was it to kind of deal with? I mean, you had success, so that's great. But like, it was a different level, right?
Yeah, totally different. I think what was good is that I had success as a junior, but not like crazy young. So I didn't have that like 14 years old winning Junior Wimbledon. I was 18 when I won Junior Wimbledon. So I think sometimes having success so young is actually tough for the brain to handle. And then I've seen it myself with some peers, like you think you've already made it and then you get to the pros and you know, you're not even like as motivated maybe, or you think you're like, you should already be good enough. And so I like my path because I did play juniors till the very end, but I think it actually helped me. I was also more mature. Mm-hmm. I was 18 when I won Junior Wimbledon. So that's better than being younger. Right. And it taught me all these lessons of like handling that pressure, like we were talked about. And so that's why I feel like I had kind of like a seamless transition into the pros because I played junior so late. And a lot of players won't do that. They'll play like the junior slams at like 15 and then decide that they're done with that. And that's just a different strategy. And it definitely works that way too. Mm-hmm. But this is the way that worked for me.
When did Coco Gauff go pro? 15-2?
I mean, I think the youngest age you're allowed to like turn pro is 14. So okay. Probably that.
Yeah. We were talking off camera before. I'm from Cincinnati, so I've covered the Western and Southern Cincinnati Open a bunch. And I remember when her and Katie McNally played doubles because Katie's from Cincinnati. And it was just crazy watching that transition. So me going back and thinking about you, like, it's just wild to think that at 15, 16 years old, you can start going pro and competing at that level.
Yeah.
You mentioned Wimbledon. That run, it's a dream come true for you to, one, just be playing in it, but go on a run like that where you are winning and winning and get to the final. Before I talk about that match, just that run when you got there, how incredible was that at 20 years old?
Mm-hmm. Well, it's interesting you say how incredible that was because obviously now I look back and feel that it was incredible. But in the moment, I mean, it felt normal. And I know that maybe sounds crazy to say, but as we just discussed the amount of time and sacrifice it took to get there, for me in my head, I was like, I've been doing this for 15 years. Like, this is what I want to achieve. This is normal. Like, look at everything I've sacrificed. Look at everything my family has sacrificed and the amount of hours of hard work, blood, sweat, and tears. Of course, I should make the fun. Like, I mean, I would be disappointed if I didn't, you know? And of course, looking back, it's like, it's amazing to have achieved that because I could have put the same blood, sweat, and tears and just not achieved it.
Yeah.
And so luckily with fate and hard work and timing, it all worked out. But it wasn't like an overnight thing at all.
It
took so many years. So I was never like surprised by it.
Well, people from the outside think it's overnight because
never heard of you. And then suddenly, you know, you do well.
Right. And so you just won the junior title 2 years prior. Now, all of a sudden, you're playing in the real Wimbledon. Mm-hmm. Like, it's completely, you know, a change for them because, again, they don't know who you are. No offense. Just yet. Like, you're young in the game trying to figure it out and make a name for yourself. You go on that run and you go to the final at Wimbledon. Things don't go your way. You lose in the final. How defeating was that? I know that might sound like a dumb question, but because you were in such a like just groove and felt like where you're supposed to be, how big of a gut punch was that loss?
That was really tough for me, especially because to get to the final, I actually hadn't lost a set. So I was really winning all my matches quite in a straightforward way. And then I got my butt kicked in a straightforward way in the finals. So it was tough. I didn't, you know, feel like I deserve to win at all because I totally, you know, got dominated on the court. But that one was, a lot of tears after that one.
You mentioned tears and emotions, like coming right off the court after that run. And like you said, like it was a really, really tough match for you. Did you feel like you could talk about how you were feeling in that moment? Like as we get to mental health, or was it just like bury it in the locker room and then go out and just try to keep winning in the next tournament?
Well, with my inner circle, I remember just going straight to my coach and like crying in his shoulder and holding the trophy and not even feeling like I deserve to hold this trophy right now and crying to my mom, of course. You know, that would say was still like expected to feel, you know, down mentally and things like that. That wasn't when I started feeling the more pressure of the whole keep your mental health wrapped up. Okay, you lost in the finals of Wimbledon. That's expected to be sad about.
Yeah, well, and going back to the final, like I asked you this before we started the interview, you still haven't watched that final. I know you probably hate this question, so that's why that's why I'm going to ask it. Sorry. But why haven't you like gone back and watched it? And I know like for a lot of sports fans watching, they might understand, but like a lot of athletes, teams, I work with football players all the time. They go back, watch the tape. I'm sure tennis players do the same thing. Mm-hmm. Why haven't you watched that back?
No, I do believe in watching tape, and I do watch.
I'm not saying that you don't.
All athletes like out there do that. But this one was just so painful that I just can't relive like the painful emotions of imagining if I could have won. I relate it to my mom, who had the birth of my brother filmed, and she said she still hasn't been able to watch that video back because. Okay. It was so painful. I'm like, okay, I feel the same way.
Okay, that is a very interesting analogy. Did not think that was going to be your answer.
You did not expect that. No. I can tell by your face.
Yeah, I was like, where are we going with this? Like, does she like you more than she likes your brother? I don't know.
She's just like, that's the only one because she has on film or something. I guess they didn't film before or I don't know what. She wanted this one on film and she's like, I still can't watch that video.
All right. So different turn than I thought.
Different type of pain, but you know.
Yeah, we get the idea. For you going back to Wimbledon, though, not asking you about watching it, but you just brought up there, that wasn't where you felt that, like, I don't know if shame or not be able to open up about your mental health. When did that come into play when you felt like, because again, in sports, and I feel like tennis, because it is an individual sport, you have to be even more macho and like have that personality and dignity and strength and all this stuff. When did that kind of phase start for you where you were bottling up emotions and felt like you couldn't let them out?
I would say that started the year after. So at some point mid-2015, because I really felt so much incredible weight of pressure and expectations, and I wasn't living up to it, and started getting, you know, tough questions in the press, hate on social media, you know, tough headlines in the news, and that's when it really started being hard for me. Mm-hmm. And I didn't, you know, expect this turnaround to happen because I was so loved and adored
right
8 months prior. But, you know, the whole narrative really shifted quickly.
That narrative shifting and you talking about being loved and now, I don't want to say you were hated, but like people giving you hate or maybe bad headlines, like you said. Mm-hmm. But how did that affect your mental health when we're not able to talk about it and be open about it? At least back then we weren't.
Exactly. No, back in the day, I mean, before a press conference, we're told like, don't admit weakness, you know, show strength and don't admit anything that like could show that you know, are less confident because your next opponent will see that and be more confident. Like you mentioned, tennis being an individual sport,
yeah,
it's almost even more important to keep that like wall up. So yeah, you know, I was just going through press conferences, just dealing with these same questions over and over again of like, okay, you've lost 6 matches in a row now. Like, people say you're too focused on doing photo shoots and not tennis training. And you know, what's happening? Why do you keep losing? And over again. And for me, it started affecting me because when you start, like, I wasn't going to seek out what people were writing on social media, but I was forced to do press conferences unless you pay a fine, which mm-hmm. we now know from Naomi Osaka. And I'm forced to hear the questions. So yeah. Like, even if I don't go on my own and doom scroll in my bed, I'm at this press conference and reporters are asking me this question and I have to respond, or at least I have to listen to them. So it's being brought to my attention. It's being forced in my face no matter what.
Yeah.
And so then through that is how I, you know, put together in my head what people are thinking about me. And, you know, when you hear something, a lot of times you almost start to believe it yourself, yeah. Right? And I look back and something I regret is kind of feeling like I let that infiltrate into my mind of mm-hmm. like, oh, what they're saying, they're all saying it, or some of them are saying it, or there's some of them are repeating it. So yeah. It must be true.
For you, when you step out of that press conference and you go to either get ready for a match the next day or go to the next tournament, maybe after a loss, like you mentioned, how do you not, like you mentioned taking that baggage with you a little bit, but how did it affect your personal life, your individual happiness? Again, you're supposed to have that, you know, plain face that it doesn't affect you. But I know from personal experience, when you step away from that spotlight, like it completely changes and you have to live with those emotions that you have.
Yeah. I would take losses really hard. So I would lose a match and want to just stay in my hotel room for like 24 hours or 48 hours and just feel like the worst person in the world. And looking back, I don't think that was right. You know, I should, okay, be sad for an hour, maybe a couple hours, maybe the rest of the day, fine. But like, you wake up, the sun comes up,
yeah,
we got to move on in life, you know? And so I would really let losses affect me. And I wish I didn't do that so much, because, you know, life is great. It's a tennis match. There are people going through so much worse in life. And I should, you know, just be grateful for what I have. I'm playing at Indian Wells. Okay, amazing. I lost my match. Okay, that's okay. Let's get on to the next. And I just like let losses like drag on into like the next week, and then it drags on to the next week, and it becomes this like vicious cycle you like play yourself into.
When did you start opening up about like the feelings or those kind of experiences, letting those losses build up mentally for you? When did you start opening up to more than just mom or coach? Did like, was there a turning point for you with that?
I mean, the only other person would be a sports psychologist, which I started, you know, seeing, and publicly, not really. Like, I never really opened up about it, because back in the day, it was kind of a taboo subject. And so I'm so happy now for all the athletes nowadays, myself included, all of us included, normal people included, of course, that we can talk about this so openly, because I was going through a really tough time and I couldn't talk about it, or else I'd be labeled like weak or like failure. And now, you know, people talk about it and they're like, oh my God, she's so open and vulnerable, and this is amazing. And it's like, why couldn't they be saying this about me when I was going through this 10 years ago, you know? So the times have totally changed.
What made you first reach out to a sports psychologist or go to therapy? Was it those moments after that loss and you were experiencing the bad headlines and the tough questions, or was there something before then? Like, when did you start going to therapy?
It's, I would say, a combination, you know, losing some matches and knowing that, okay, I'm still the same body. I still have the same physical capabilities. Maybe when I had tough matches, like mental matches, like losing tough ones in the third set, realizing, okay, like I want to maybe work on my mental brain. And like we talked about this before, I mean, we, you know, spend so much time training our muscles, but like we don't train this muscle, you know what I mean? And it's like, we all should do that. Everyone on this planet should do that.
If you don't have your mental health, you have nothing. Like, you can't perform physically. Sorry to interrupt, but it's like, just, that's so true. Like, if you don't take care of it up here, then like, how are you expected to do anything else?
Exactly. Exactly. So really helping me like control my thoughts, or letting, you know, the negative thoughts just pass through, therefore helping me regulate my emotions, because I would start thinking a bad thought, then I would have a bad emotion, and then I'd do a bad action. And it was just this trifecta. And so it's like kind of catching it right away, but it takes discipline and it takes work. Just like how you have to work your bicep in the gym, you have to like be so aware that when you do have a bad thought, you're like catching it right away, and you're, you know, doing all the tools that you get taught. And so I feel like that helped me. But, you know, really, I feel like I only really progressed at that as I got a bit older. Even a couple of years after the tough 2015 year, was still, you know, felt that burden on my shoulders. And I did better, you know, after that year still, but I still felt like I could have done even better. And so, you know, still like grappling with that for a couple of years, I would say.
Yeah. And you mentioned those next couple of years, and that's when, if I'm doing my math right, the injuries start to come too. And I mean, you talk about like being at the top of the game, being in the final at Wimbledon, then going through this time where mentally maybe you're not performing as well as you want to on the court, and like it's affecting you a little bit, but then injuries happen. That's out of your control. That's something that like you hear so much with athletes affecting their mental health. How much did that play into kind of your struggle and this quiet, I don't know if you want to call it like depression, anxiety, but that you were battling these next couple years after Wimbledon?
Yeah. I mean, look, I just felt so much pressure and expectations from the outside world. It's like, oh, you got to the finals of a slam. Well, then you should win one next year, and you should win two the year after. And it's like, unless you're Serena Williams or Roger Federer or Novak Djokovic or Rafa, like you, nothing's a guarantee. Nothing's a given. And to even achieve anything like what I did is obviously great in the sport. But I got made fun of, or like I felt bad because like I got to five and then I went down to 50. And so like that was terrible. But if I had never gotten to five and I just did a slow, like work my way up to 50, that would be amazing.
Right.
So it's like, why am I being made felt terrible because of something amazing I achieved? You know, that's like where I would like be confused. I'm like, wait, I achieved something amazing and now I feel terrible about it.
Right. Because they're putting you on this pedestal or thinking that, and you, I mean, you can win and do anything you put your mind to, but like if you're at five, like you said, you should win one slam next year, two, like you should just go on this run that only a few, Serena, Roger.
Of course.
Like these greats go on, and you're great at what you do. I'm not like putting you down. I'm just saying like the expectations sometimes can be so unrealistic. And for me, like that's what I've learned. One of the most annoying sports like things that I've heard in every locker room, you get coach talk. Look, I'm on the other side of those press conferences you're complaining about. I'm the one asking the
questions. You're the bad guy.
I know. I'm not the asshole asking, why are you losing again? That's not me. I do good stories. But like how do you... It's so like controlling what you can control. It's something I would hate to hear. The older I got, the more that like I dealt with mental health struggles. Like you can only like deal with what you can, like control what you can control. It's such an annoying phrase, but I think it's true. And it sounds like over your career, especially like probably when you got to that injury point, that is when you had to come to that realization, because like you can do all the training, you can play really, really well. All it takes is one thing in your shoulder to feel that, or one bad step, and it's like my season's over.
Totally. So I think starting to have some of the physical injuries actually taught me a lot for the mental side, and taking that time to rehab something I physically really had to rehab, you know, made me work on my mind as well. It made me work on like the patience of having to be out, making me grateful and appreciative of everything I have and the chance to play on the tennis tour and this be my job and make a living out of it. And so then when I came back from those injuries, I felt better mentally because like of the forced timeout from the physical injury, if that makes sense.
No, it does, because it makes you grateful. It gives you perspective. When you get back to playing, how did you not like keep that baggage with you? Was it like the more therapy you went to? Was it having that perspective? Was it just, not saying you weren't grown up before, but like us growing up, like was it just time that you've learned how to be a pro and how to be grateful as a person on your own too?
I think a little bit of that maturity, because that gave me perspective. Like I said, in the moment, making the finals of Wimbledon, I'm like, this is normal. But then a year later, I'm like, wow, that was amazing. 2 years later, I'm like, wow, that was amazing. And, you know, I'll still always look back so fondly of those memories. So maturity, perspective really helped. Therapy, my therapist straight up telling me, Jeannie, nobody cares about you, in a way of like, stop worrying about whatever other people think.
Yeah.
Obviously, I care about my inner circle, the important people to me, I care about what they think. But it was more of just like letting go of everything else. She was like, look, they'll flip the channel on, watch you play tennis, and then they'll flip the channel and go watch football. And it's like, you have to like stop being so self-centered almost, you know? I think we all care too much about what other people think. And that is something that hugely affects mental health. I mean, you look at social media and all that stuff. I mean, it's literally all about other people's lives and trying to show how cool your life is and looking at how cool everyone else's lives are. So that was great. When you really just like, I find it like humbles me to be like, okay, no one actually cares. Like,
yeah, gives a shit. Like they can go on with their life.
Exactly,
I'll go on with mine.
Exactly. Like, why should I care so much about what someone who I've never even met thinks?
Yeah.
You know, and who cares what they think about my life? And I don't even know their life to have an opinion on it. And what does it matter? Like, I'm going to live my life. I'm never going to encounter them. And, you know, they're not going to be there when I'm on my deathbed. Like, you know, it's just this crazy, like putting things into perspective of like, get out of your own head. Like, everything's fine. Life is great. Like, just go play tennis.
I'm going to plug the name of the show, but it is a mental game.
Exactly. So it's like controlling that and like not just controlling it, but like just taking a step back and like realizing things.
Right. You know? Well, and what's your favorite part about therapy? Like you mentioned your therapist telling you to like get out of your own head or not care what people think, or that you are self-centered, which like you're not, but like in those moments you can see how the analogy works.
Yeah.
What's your favorite part about therapy?
Well, you know, sometimes when I know I have like my therapy session coming up, I'm dreading it. You know, I'm like, oh, I'm gonna have to do this. Like I'm gonna have to open up and I'm gonna have to say all these things. And every single time I'm done, I'm always feel better. Like every single time. And sometimes I'm like, I have things I know I want to talk about. And then other times I'm like, oh, this is going to be pointless. I don't even know. I don't even have something I want to talk about. And then boom, an hour goes by and it's like, wow, like stuff came up I didn't even realize.
Yeah.
And so I just love just being able to talk about vulnerable things, embarrassing things, emotional things. I kind of have a little bit of a wall up as a personality, but inside the wall is very soft. So, you know, not many people see that. And you know, a therapist is someone who does. So it's nice to be able to get stuff off your chest like that. But the biggest thing is also just learning. I mean,
yeah.
These are people with professional experience and degrees and so much insight onto how human psychology works. And I love hearing their advice of like, you know, when I need to be put in my place, I love being put in my place. Like, please put me in my place and tell me that like my thoughts are just spiraling.
Well, it's like when you see it start working, that's what made the difference for me. Like when I was someone that, I'll be honest, like 10 years ago, like we were talking about, you didn't talk about it. I don't think I even like thought mental health was a thing. And right. like you go through your own struggles and you hit rock bottom and it's like, oh shit, like I really do need help. And like my favorite thing about therapy one is that it's like an unbiased person that just wants to help you feel better. Like my therapist didn't know who any of the football players were, didn't know who I was, never watched anything I did on TV, but like she helped me deal with this breakup and this death in the family. It's like, oh, if you just do these one, two things, I'll talk to you in a couple of weeks and like tell me how it goes. When you start seeing it work, it makes that like kind of change. When did you start seeing like therapy work for you in the real world outside of, I don't know if you do online or in person, but like outside of that therapy appointment?
Yeah. So, well, I would say there are two different types for me. So I would do like sports psychology. And I was usually more on the phone. I'm on the road, you know, kind of in between tournaments and things like that. And then I also, even as I got older, like started just seeing regular life therapists. And I like to try as much in person as possible. And that's just more like life, like me as a human being, which I felt was also helpful to go just to even show myself like, hey, my whole life is not about tennis. My whole life is not about sports. I can talk about my personal emotions, relationships, family, you know, fears and everything else that has nothing to do with my day job. And so with that, I mean, you kind of start talking and you just realize how much stuff maybe you were holding inside. And that's when I realized like, okay, wow. It's like sometimes you know something's true, but then you hear yourself say it and you realize it's like something you needed to say.
Oh yeah. Well, and you mentioned like the difference between sport and tennis and like your personal life. And so I'm going to ask you something kind of deep here, but that's the point of the show. Like, do you realize looking back now, have you hit a rock bottom personally while battling all the stuff off the court of what people said about you and maybe not winning as much on the court as you would used to? Do you remember hitting a rock bottom and like, what was that moment like if so?
Well, I mean, I would like to preface it by saying, I don't think it was, I've been lucky to not have a huge rock bottom moment in my life so far. And the closest thing would be just the toughness in my career and in my job. So I'm grateful for that. Of course, I would definitely just say after a couple tough losses in 2015 where I was like, you know, just finished a press conference where someone told me it was like 11 matches in a row that I lost. And I like didn't even realize it was that many. And I just like locked myself in my hotel room. And even like my mom or my brother has to like coax me out, you know, and be like, come on. And I liked being in my hotel room after losses because it kind of was like, I wasn't facing reality yet. You know, it's cause like, it's almost like the loss doesn't set in if I don't go back out on the sidewalk after. So I was like in the suspended, like, time where like I could pretend like nothing had really happened. And but that's when I was younger, and so for me those were really tough times. And now, you know, I would never do that. I would never waste a day like that. And I feel like life is too short. Life is so precious. And so I feel bad for my younger self feeling it was almost like self-punishment, you know, like I felt like I had to not enjoy a day the next day because I lost. You know what I mean?
I do. And you think, you look back now at yourself and you realize, obviously through therapy and just growing up and self-worth and all these things that you learn, you know, while talking with a therapist or sports psychologist, like, oh, I didn't have to escape this. Like I didn't, it doesn't have to be an escape from reality. I know, look, like losing's tough or anything you can go through in life's tough, but I learned the tools through therapy or through myself of how to move on or how to move forward, I guess, right?
And having more of that life experience and that perspective also puts whatever it is you're sad about in perspective. So when I was younger, each loss just felt more important. Like there's this magnitude to a loss. And now that I'm older, I'm like, I see it more, I would say objectively, like with a different lens, like my feet, you know, I see the whole forest and not just in the trees. Right.
Yeah.
So I feel like that has helped a lot, being kind of more objective and less emotional about the losses and kind of looking at it more matter of fact. Okay, this happened, this happened, this happened.
Yeah.
So I'm going to do this, this, this next week. And, you know, I'm going to move on and not like dwell, because if you force yourself to dwell, you're like making yourself unhappy.
And yeah,
I don't agree that people can be happy all the time. I think it's natural in life to go through the different emotions. Mm-hmm. But like, if you're tormenting yourself and it's like self-inflicted pain, yeah, that's not healthy. And that's making it worse. Yes, I would be sad for 2 hours, but I would make myself sad for like, right, 24 more hours. So that's where like you have to draw the line.
Yeah, I look at myself, and you don't know this about me, but I was like an alcoholic, big drinker, partier. And so like I look at when I would I'd be in these moments, yeah, and instead of like going to do something that I like, a healthy coping mechanism, whether it's going to Orange Theory or just listening to music, whatever it is, I would just get drunk, and that makes it worse. Like, right, turning to things that like don't help you, the unhealthy, healthy coping mechanisms.
Exactly. Exactly. You have to be aware and be like, I know I'm self-sabotaging right now by like, right, doing this unhealthy coping mechanism. And yep, you have to be strong enough and disciplined to be like, to change the actions. And that's the hard part though. And I feel like that's maybe what people struggle with, is like having that strength or that resolve or that discipline to be like, no, I'm going to do this.
What's your healthy coping mechanism? I'm going to, like, you can say tennis and then we can move to another one, because I know that's your job too, but like it is part of you. And so I'm sure that does help, like to just go play practice when you are having a tough moment or a tough day. Mm-hmm. But what are coping mechanisms that do help you through those moments?
I mean, it's funny you say tennis, because I didn't used to think it was. And then I would realize like when I feel in turmoil or I don't know, family issues or things like that, I would go practice and be like, oh my God, this is like my salvation.
Yeah.
This feels so good. I don't think about any problems for like 2 hours. This is amazing. So tennis is of course one, but that's my job, so I don't really consider it. I mean, my favorite thing, I love journaling. I think it's really important to like get your thoughts out of your head and mm-hmm. onto paper. And I love that because I could be like lying in bed. Sometimes I struggled with like falling asleep yep. when I would be so stressed about playing tournaments and stuff. Like that was probably a really big issue of mine. And I realized if I could just write the thoughts down, they would stop like swirling in my head.
Yeah.
You know, it's like, it's literally like physically getting them out on paper. I like handwriting because I think it's more important. Mm-hmm. I obviously have my notes app in my phone full of a bunch of notes, as yeah. I'm sure we all do. But like really like a piece of paper and a pen and just yeah. get it out. And sometimes I don't even know what I'm going to write. And I just start writing and stuff comes out. And
you learn stuff about yourself through
that. Exactly. It's like, wow, I didn't know I felt so strongly. And I read it back and I'm like, holy crap. Okay. Like this was something. And I didn't even know I had this thought today, but I wrote it out and here it is. So it's super important to like just, it's like a purge. It's like, get yeah. it out, you know?
Journaling's one of the most popular ones that I hear. You know, I travel the country, talk about mental health, and obviously do this show, like journaling, painting, if you're a musician, songwriting, or you know, playing music, obviously sports, playing those sports. We've talked a lot yeah. during this about how the stigma has changed from, you know, we're like basically the same age. I think we're both 30. So like from when we were 20 to 30, a lot has changed, especially yeah. in sports. Looking at how it's changed, how exciting is that for you? You mentioned Naomi before, mm-hmm. and she did it at the biggest stage in tennis. How inspiring were her words, movements like this the last 2, 3, 4, 5 years, where it is okay in sports, especially where you're supposed to be this tough person, not be weak or emotional, but for us to be able to talk about our mental health, how encouraging has that change been for your perspective?
I think it's been great. It shows that she's human, and it created this like relatability factor where it's like, we don't have to pretend all the time, you know?
Yeah.
And that's how I felt when I was younger, that like everyone was pretending. So I had to pretend also, even though of course we have days where we feel weak and we lost and we feel terrible and yeah. you know, or we have a tournament coming up and we don't feel confident, you know, and you always had to pretend that like everything was perfect all the time. And so it really just like broke that facade. And I think it's great that I think it helps not just like other athletes, but all normal people to be like, hey, like this superstar is human and feels terrible about this tournament and doesn't want to play or doesn't want to do this. And it just makes us all like be like, I don't know, I feel like it can almost like bring everyone together. You yeah. know what I mean? Like we're not so all far apart. Like, yeah, right. of course. In a normal person's job, they don't feel like going to work. Okay, when I wake up sometimes, I don't want to play a tennis match today. I just yeah. feel so much pressure and anxiety. I don't want to play. And I think that just makes us seem just so much more relatable.
I think one of the like, or two of the most impactful athletes, you know, ever publicly speaking about it, Naomi 1, Simone Biles mm-hmm. 2, just when they did it, before the Olympics, before a big tennis tournament, and just because of their stature in sports, them being, you know, female athletes and maybe, you know, some getting some harder questions sometimes that maybe the male athletes don't get. Did you feel like that was empowering too, that it was like, you know, I'm gonna throw Simone in there with Naomi, mm-hmm. but like two very strong female athletes speaking out about mental health kind of broke the stigma at once, big together, it felt like.
Totally. And I think it was not too far apart when they both yeah. actually happened. I think it was the same summer when it was like the French Open for Naomi and the Olympics, yeah. right, for Simone Biles. Yeah, I mean, it was just, I mean, it took courage, I would say, because you have to really believe in what you're saying and believe that what you're feeling is important enough that, you know, you want people to know about it. And mm-hmm. it's a negative thing. It's not a positive thing, right? Like, oh, yeah. I don't feel ready enough to perform in this event or whatever right. it was for Simone. But I think it just caused everyone to be like, okay, like we can relax. We can like tear these walls down a yeah. little bit and just be all normal about it and not just pretend like everything's perfect. I just, that idea of like, I'm a bit of a perfectionist myself. So that's something I'm trying to work on, you know? And like, can we just all stop trying to pretend to be perfect, that we must achieve perfection?
Yeah.
All of that is just like, I feel like stress inducing, you mm-hmm. know? And I feel like that just caused everyone to be like, okay, like it's okay.
Did that change? Like, you guys are traveling each and every week for mm-hmm. tournaments. You're in the locker room together. You're practicing together. Did that change? Like when, I know this has been an ongoing conversation in sport and in tennis, but like when she took that stand and talked about her own mental health, did it like have a ripple effect inside the women's tour too?
I would say people just slowly over the years have been more open about, you know, physical injuries, mentally not feeling that good, just yeah. more like, hey, like everything's not perfect all the time. And so obviously when you have people that talk about it in such a public way like that, it totally like breaks the stigma immediately, like you said. And I would definitely say I would say it was trending already in that direction, yeah. but with those specific girls doing that, it was definitely like, oh yeah, like I could talk to a tennis friend and be like, oh, I'm so anxious or nervous for my match today. And it's something yeah. we never would have said right. in the locker room 10 years ago. Like we wouldn't even admit to that 10 years ago. Like think about how crazy that
even is. To yourself.
I know.
Breaking the stigma. You've heard us talk about it throughout this episode with Jeannie, and especially when it comes to sports. She mentioned when she first started playing tennis, she would never talk about how she was feeling, if she was anxious or nervous before a match or struggling with her mental health at all, because we were all taught to just rub dirt on it and play through it if we're feeling weak. We're not supposed to talk about how we're feeling, but things have changed, and that's why I want to tell you about Man Therapy. Guys, I'm talking to you. Think about, you know, you've heard us say in women's sports, Naomi Osaka, Simone Biles, they were trendsetters when it came to mental health and being vulnerable on and off the field or court. Same things happened on the men's side of sports with guys in the NBA like Kevin Love, or in the NFL with Brandon Marshall, and so many athletes across the world and in every league. We have to talk about how we're feeling and be vulnerable. And as us fans watching, sometimes we might cry about our favorite team losing, or we might be a little mad about what happened in fantasy football this week. But look, we got to talk about a lot more things than just sports. We got to talk about our lives and the things that we're going through. And that's why you need to go to mantherapy.org, where Man Therapy can help you with your mental health with incredible tools, resources, tips, and things like their 18-point head inspection, which is a quick 2-minute test that'll ask you questions about your mental health to try to help you the best take care of yourself. Guys, I took it before. It helped me a lot. Just conversational questions about your everyday life and your mental health that'll help point you in the right direction when it comes to things like therapy or coping mechanisms or just things that can help you with your mental health. So go to mantherapy.org to help your mental health today. It's wild to me to think about that. And you mentioned the word relatable, which is like the reason why I created this show, because people think that if you're playing in the final at Wimbledon, or you're performing your song in front of 20,000 people, mm-hmm. or you're in the Super Bowl, you have zero problems. And the reason why I created this show was to like show that you can relate to your favorite athlete. You can relate to your favorite musician. So like there might be a young aspiring tennis player who watches you and goes, oh, Jeannie goes to therapy. Like, oh, if I'm struggling with this, maybe I can too. Or like even setting boundaries. And I'm not saying like you did anything wrong growing up, but like mm-hmm. kids back when we were growing up felt like they couldn't speak up if they were overwhelmed, whether it be school or work or practice. Like mm-hmm. it's okay to like say, hey, look, I got so much going on, coach. Can we go a little lighter today? Or mom, like, can I have an hour before I do chores? Like different things like that. The relatability thing, that is the biggest thing with me for mental health.
Mm-hmm. I totally agree with that. And I think it makes us, everyone just remember that we're all human. I would like to say that I do find my perfectionism, I know there are cons to it, but there are pros as well. And it's a driving force. And it's something for me that made me disciplined and work hard. And I don't want to, take away the fact that you can't just, let's say have a mental health excuse to like get out of things that you should be doing. Or, I just don't want the pendulum to swing too far either.
Yeah.
I think it's very important and that it's great that we're so open about it. But I also want to emphasize that there's no way around the hard work, you know, and you can't get somewhere if you're constantly like avoiding something or if you're constantly like
calling out sick or
exactly. So I know if there's a real issue, of course, but I don't want it to be abused because then I feel like it negatively impacts people who actually have issues.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
No, I agree with you too. And I grew up in a time just like you, where it's like, you put your head down, you just do whatever. I think I cater more obviously towards the mental health side because that's my profession now, my passion, but like I still have that in me of it's like, oh, like flying here to do this interview, this isn't throwing you under the bus, but it's like I was up at 2 a.m. on the East Coast and here, late last night, and then it's like I'm flying out early tomorrow morning. It's like, I want to come do the interview and it's going to be really great and an awesome conversation, but like you have to make sacrifices and like work hard to get where you want to be. I mean, you experienced that with your tennis career, I've done it with TV and journalism. Mm-hmm. It's just like you can give yourself grace, which I think is the important thing, and you can reach out and ask for help, but you still have to do the work.
Exactly. And I think that balance, just like everything in life, this is so cliche, but you need the balance, you know?
Yep.
So it's like if I'm working hard and I'm training hard but then I don't feel so good, I think maybe what I can do is like acknowledge it or tell someone about it or adjust something that day because of it. But I'm not going to adjust something every single day for the rest of my career. You know? It's like one of those, it's like maybe take it as it comes and adjust as things go, but like not to just throw everything away or not even give yourself a chance, So there's that fine line where I just, really want to never not emphasize the fact that it's like, you have to do the hard work. You have to do the discipline. Maybe now we can acknowledge that it's hard, that it sucks.
Yeah.
That it's like, I had to, you know how many sleepovers I had to miss when I was a kid? You know how many birthday parties I had to miss? So now I can be like, hey, that was so annoying. You know how many family Christmases I had to miss?
Yep.
That really sucked. But guess what? I still wanted to do the sacrifice, but at least I can be open and be like, okay, this made me feel this way. I missed out on this event. Next family event, I'm going to make sure I'm there.
Yep.
Blah, blah, blah. And kind of like compromise.
Validating the feelings.
Right.
That's so big. You mentioned like missing family parties. I've never been to a bachelor party. The first time I ever had 2 weekends off in a row was like when I had to check myself into a hospital for my mental health. It's like, it's crazy.
I wouldn't really call that a weekend off.
Yeah, it wasn't really a weekend off, but like, I'm just saying like, it is crazy looking back at some of the things you missed. And then as the older you get, you want to enjoy those things, those moments.
Totally.
We talk about working hard. I can tell, and obviously I knew this, like watching you play and listening to some other interviews before this, you're very competitive. And so like in a good way, I'm not saying that's a bad thing. You're competitive, perfectionist, you said yourself, but like it makes you want to have that edge. And so when you're going through all this and you start taking care of yourself, you start getting back on the court, you start playing. Did you feel that like, that internal happiness again, playing once you got through it, like sounded like it was 2014 to maybe 16 was kind of tough for you mentally and you weren't talking about it. But when did you feel okay playing again and like just being yourself and having fun playing a game that you love?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, I would say, it was up and down a little bit. Of course I had good moments in 2016 and I was, back in the top 50 and everything like that. I would say still some tough ones in 17 as well. And 18 pro. I mean, look, every year, tough moments. What am I talking about? Okay. But I would definitely say it's more of this feeling of just like the first word I told you, like stability, like just feeling stable inside, just feeling that peace inside.
Yeah.
And going back out on the court after some tough injuries and being like, this won't like change my life, whether I win or lose. And like being able to kind of detach a little bit from the outcome for me helped me not feel that pressure and expectation so much. And I was like, hey, I was just out for shoulder surgery for an entire year. Life was okay. I mean, I wasn't playing tennis, which made me sad, but I was able to do other things in life and I actually could live in like a normal life. And hey, whenever I do retire, that's going to be great. And that's going to be fun. And I realized that, I just didn't want to like tie every single tennis match result to like my soul and my identity. I mean, that's just a burden no one should have to carry. And
right.
I feel like I did a better job of lightening that burden.
I think that's one of the most powerful things you've said the entire interview, just because it's like a sport. It can be your sport, but it shouldn't define you. Mm-hmm. And that's what I hear from athletes over and over again. Mm-hmm. You get back on the court playing tennis. You've also taken up a new love for pickleball, which I, or you, was it pickle? People just call it pickle?
It's just like shorthand, just trying to be cool about it.
Oh, all right. Well, so pickle, how'd you get into pickle? Like why, like obviously you've played tennis for your whole life.
Yeah.
Similar, different, like how did you get into it?
So different, first of all, let me tell you. Yeah, it just came up as like this opportunity last year. The PPA tour is the professional tour for pickleball players. And I think they were really interested in having some tennis players be part of their tour. And I was super excited at the opportunity and agreed to do some events for them this year and be on the tour. So I just had an event last week here in LA. And it is not like tennis at all. I mean, I also want to talk about pressure and expectations. I mean, I felt this crushing weight of having to suddenly perform and be amazing at pickleball just because I'm a tennis player.
Yeah.
But it's like, I've played for a couple of months and I'm playing against pros who have, you know, practiced these specific skills for
right.
5 years or 10 years. Some of them came from tennis from their early days, but still
yeah.
they're like practicing only pickleball in a professional way for years. And
right.
I just got thrown into the deep end of like, go play, you know, pro events. And, you know, my first three events, I lost at every event. I play singles, doubles, and mixed. Mm-hmm. And so I lost all three at my first three events. So I was 0-9. And, you know, that was like a monkey on my back. And then finally in North Carolina, a couple weeks ago, I won my first mixed doubles match and my first singles match.
Nice.
So I was like, okay, the monkey's off my back. I showed I can play a little
I
bit.
I can do this.
I can do it. I want to be much better, of course, because that's just who I am. But
yeah.
at least I'm not like having this dread. So, you know, I had it a little bit this year too.
Did you play at all like when it started coming up, or was it just like, because I, mm-hmm. my friends talk about it all the time. I still have not played pickleball.
Everyone I know is so obsessed with it. It's crazy. I started playing a couple years ago, I think out of COVID kind of is
yeah.
when it really started becoming popular. And so I would play with friends for fun, you know, nothing professional, but
yeah.
I would play and everyone would just talk about it and be obsessed with it. And I would see tennis courts being turned into pickleball
it's crazy.
Courts all over the place. And as a tennis player, that hurts my soul. But as also a pickleball player, I'm like, I'm part of this like trending movement. I mean,
yeah.
it's unbelievable. It's the fastest growing sport in the US.
Yeah, it's wild to look at. You mentioned like tennis courts being changed into pickleball courts, like in Cincinnati, like not close to the venue at the Western and Southern, but like downtown, there mm-hmm. was like 20 tennis courts right on the river. Now, like I think half of them, if not three fourths of them, are pickleball courts.
Mm-hmm. I'm surprised it's not more than that, but yeah.
yeah, it's wild to me, but like, yeah. it just seems like, and I still have not played it, which I need to go do.
Are you resisting on purpose or what?
No, I'm not. I'm a huge ping pong player and I'm really good at that.
Oh, I think pickleball is like big form version of ping pong.
Really?
Yeah. People say it's like mini tennis. I think it's more life-size version of ping pong.
So are you good at ping pong?
No.
Okay.
That's
so
my
that
problem.
Would, I wish we had a ping pong table at this Airbnb for the interview because then we could settle that.
Oh, there's nothing to settle. Yeah. I will give it to you. I will okay. admit you will win.
Yeah, that's. I just haven't played. There's nothing I'm against it. It's just like, I don't know. Kind of you talk about like the grind of what you're doing, what you're working on. It's just like, I would rather send emails for 3 hours and mm-hmm. listen to my favorite song than like go play pickleball with my friends. But I think I'm going to eventually have to give in. Why do you love it so much? And why do you think it's grown so much?
Well, many reasons. Number one, even if you have never played before, you can have a rally right away. That's the biggest thing with tennis. If you try to pick up tennis when you've never played, you're going to spend the entire hour picking up balls from the court because it's too hard. So it's very easy to pick up. Number two, it's very social. You can just go to a court and kind of jump in and join games. I have friends, like girlfriends that are my age that will be like, I play pickleball just to meet people, like just to like...
I've heard this.
Just to make friends.
Even on that, my dating life is non-existent. My buddies have been like, dude, just show up and play. I'm like, no, I'm not just going to, I don't go walk up to people at bars. I don't drink anymore. But like, I never walked up to people at bars. I'm not going to go walk up to them playing pickleball. But apparently that community is like totally different.
Oh, it's a whole thing. I didn't know it either until I really got into it in the last couple of months. And so for those reasons, I think people like feeling like they can do something well. And
yeah.
it doesn't take that much effort to at least just have a rally. It's easier, you know, it's easier to just have a rally than tennis. The professional level is not easy. I would say the recreational level is, you know, normal people can just have a nice rally and that's fun. Tennis,
yeah.
you can't do that. Tennis, you need to have played when you were younger or really invest a lot of hours for it to start becoming fun.
Right.
And you also need to find someone that is a similar level as you.
Yeah.
And pickleball, you can be different levels and it's more of an equalizer. So that's why people enjoy just going to play with friends.
I think I would get whooped right away in pickleball because I've never played it, but.
But look, it's a bigger plastic wiffle ball.
Yeah.
And you have, it's kind of like a bigger ping pong paddle because there's no strings. So it's really like a paddle. So that's why I call it like life size.
Can you put spin on it?
You can, but it's not like strings of a tennis racket. So it's different. Gotcha. That was a big learning curve for me.
Okay.
Like, I'm trying to like put spin, like a lot of tops and the ball's under the net and I'm trying to hit up and it's not going up.
You know
what I mean? So you have to adjust when you're in the kitchen, the short court, all those small dinks and the little short balls.
Yeah.
That's really hard for me too.
All right. Well, I know you're having fun with pickleball and you're on tour right now with the PPA. You're still playing tennis as well. Walk me through goals for you. I mean, you've had a great career playing tennis. This new pickleball adventure is something that you're having a ton of fun with. How do you balance both and what are goals for both when you're playing tennis and pickleball?
Well, this is the first year of doing both. So it's definitely like an exploratory year to see how it goes. I know I want to play both because I love tennis and that's my dream. And I'm supposed to play a tournament in 2 weeks. And so I'm excited for that one. And then I have all my other pickle events lined up. So it's kind of like, see how it goes for me, you know, because this is something new. It's something I've never done. And then besides that, you know, I have off-court projects I love doing as well. I'm in the process of hopefully coming through with making a movie and other things.
Oh, I'm going to get into that.
Possibly TV shows. We have like a lot of other stuff going on. And so in my spare time, like that's what I'm working on. And I'm, you know, doing calls and emails for all that kind of stuff. And I would say goals are just to be everything I can be, you know, do whatever I can in pickle, in tennis, in my off-court endeavors, and just try to do as much as I can while keeping balance of life. But I truly enjoy working. So I think just having all these projects is really fulfilling.
You mentioned the movie. Is this based off the date off Twitter?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
I have to ask you about it. I know you've been asked about it a million times.
Oh, come at me with all your questions.
It is like one of the greatest social media moments ever.
I appreciate that. Yes. Please go tell all the studios we're going to try sell to.
Okay. All right. Will do. I have some connects now that I've started working
when
out here.
When you move to LA for real, I'm going to need you to come to my pitches.
All right. I will help sell and pitch in a month. Look, I started a show where I had no connections in LA or New York. I can get a hold of anybody. So like I can help with that.
Love it.
If you need me. But that story, when you were watching the Super Bowl, it was the Patriots and Falcons.
Yep.
Patriots are up 28 or down. Patriots are down 28-3. And you tweet out if the Patriots win.
No, I had tweeted, I knew Atlanta would win. And then then this guy tweets back, look, I'm on the couch with my mom and my younger brother. Literally, I was lying down on my couch, bored out of my mind because it was kind of a one-sided game.
Yeah.
And I'm looking through my replies, which I never do. And someone had replied to my Atlanta tweet, if the Patriots win, come back and win, let's go on a date. And then I publicly responded like, sure. And when I happened to respond was when the game was at its most extreme deficit, which was 28-3, like halfway through the third quarter.
Yep.
Like the odds makers had that at like 0.01%.
Yeah.
It was actually insane. But of course, Tom Brady, lo and behold, does his magic, comes back and wins. And then the next day it's like number one story on CNN, number one story on BBC. Like my uncle lives in London. He's like calling me. He's like, why are you all over the news? I was getting recognized on the sidewalk as the Twitter girl. I wasn't like, yeah, I've never done anything else in my life. I'm no tennis, nothing like that. I was like, are you that Twitter girl? I was like, yep, that's me.
That's me. Well, you ended up taking him on a date ended up not being a weirdo, even though he had, what was his, not emoji, what was his avatar?
His display pic was a picture of Tiger Woods.
And you're so just like, what
I was
crazy
like,
guy is
oh
this?
Oh no, this is going to be a super fan.
This is what they warn you about.
Exactly. This is like the people you do not interact with on social media. And I just went and did that publicly in front of everybody. And he ended up being a good looking boy who's going to the University of Missouri. And it looked like we could actually date. And so we went on some dates and people just love the fact that, you know, someone shot his shot and achieve the goal. I feel like it just gave everybody hope. And like in today's world, we all just need hope. You know what I mean?
This is such a wholesome answer. It's like when it's funny because I went to the University of Cincinnati the same time Travis Kelce did. We don't know each other, but we have a ton of mutual friends from the football team and just different things at school. But like when he shot a shot with Taylor and they started dating, I'm just going to fight back on what you just said about giving people hope because people were like, oh my God, see, it pays off when you shoot your shot. I'm like, Okay, Travis Kelce got a little bit more of an edge than like random guy on Twitter.
Of course. No, so that's already, he's already like,
yeah, he's one of those
pretty
favorite,
in the same stratosphere, let's say. But this guy, obviously just like a normal guy, obviously would have never heard of any other way.
Right.
And so I feel like, you know, there's just so much negativity in the news that people really just had so much hope that like something like this could happen. And it wasn't about even me personally. It was just about any person you look up to or celebrity or anybody, not even a celebrity, like your neighbor, you think she's hot, like shoot your shot, you know, just go for it. What do you have to lose?
All right. Well, maybe I'll do that when I get home. Again, no game, but you guys went to, you took him courtside at a Knicks game.
I did. He got me Tiffany earrings before the game. So, you know,
wow, this guy went in. That's awesome. And then you guys like went on a couple other dates after that. Still keep in touch. Good friends to this day.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, so he actually has a girlfriend right now and he posted her on his story like 2 days ago. And I responded with the heartbroken emoji and he just left me on red.
Oh my God.
Yeah, I could literally show you my phone and show you
after
it.
Everything you guys have been through.
Mm-hmm. Every once in a while we'll text and we'll keep in touch now, but we both actually admitted to ourselves how we ruined each other's dating lives because he of course became like the most famous popular guy at his school, but then he said the girls would like be confused. They would be like, why do you want to date me after if you've been able to date Jeannie? And that it like totally like messed up their psyche. And then I was like, well, dude, I'm in a similar boat. Like everyone thinks we're dating now or we're still dating or whatever. And I can't get a date to save my life. So now we're both just like stuck. So like, hey, we might as well date. No, I'm kidding.
That is, I was saying like, are you guys getting married or what? That's incredible. I love that. I was going to get into like fun moments and that just popped up because you're talking about the movie. I will help however I can, if I can. You know, I've had Terry Crews on the show. I'm trying to think of other actors I've had on the show. Kate Flannery from The Office, who played Meredith. Okay. Maybe we can work in some magic there here in Hollywood. Fun moments from your career. When you look back and you're still playing, I'm not saying it's over. I'm just saying like looking back at big moments from when you were 20, playing Wimbledon or things that maybe stand out to you personally that you haven't shared before. What are your favorite memories playing tennis?
Oh my gosh. You know, I'm going to write a book one day and I'll make sure that these are all included.
Well, you already are because you're journaling.
Yes, I know. And that's why it's so important to journal as well and to keep track of what you're up to because, you know, human memory fades. And I will go back and read my journals and be shocked at what I'm reading. Absolutely shocked. And I've been like, there's no way I would have remembered this. So write down important things that happened to you and dates and timelines and keep everything organized so that I can have like a stack of journals, give it to my ghostwriter. Be like, write my book. No, I'm kidding. I'll be very much part of the process. Gosh, I could say so many things. I mean, the first one that popped into my head was like, I got to play tennis with Justin Bieber. I was playing doubles with him at a charity event years and years and years ago.
That's sick. Mm-hmm. Two Canadians together playing tennis.
Yeah, I love my Canadian homies. Drake, I'm friends with, love him. He's so sweet. Like, we all got to support each other, you know? Yeah. I just met Shania Twain this past summer.
Oh, wow. Like,
love her. So, you know, meeting cool people in different fields is really interesting for me because they understand the sacrifice, even though they didn't do exactly what you did.
Yeah.
They obviously went through adversity in their life and tough moments and so much sacrifice to achieve something special. Because to achieve something crazy, you have to do something crazy to get there.
1,000%.
And to be able to meet other people that do that as well, that I've done and other people like that outside of the tennis world has been just so like kind of fulfilling, I guess, to talk to them about it and just be kind of opened up into all these different new worlds. Like I'm so impressed by like musicians and people like that because I have no creativity in me. And I'm like, wow, what you do is just so amazing. Like, I don't care what I can do on a tennis court. What you can do is just phenomenal.
I saw Justin Bieber like 2 years ago on tour and like his live shows. Have you been to one?
Yeah.
It absolutely incredible. Also, you probably just did the biggest name drops we've ever had on this show. You're like, yeah, I'm friends with Justin Bieber, Drake.
Oh, well, but these are like my Canadian like homies. You know what I mean?
And they're like, it's like we're friends, but like
we stick together. No, we support each other, which I think is super cool. And I wish the best for all of them. And I just am proud, I guess.
Yeah.
You know, it's fun to like, especially with Shania's story. She's from such a small town in Canada. And I remember growing up looking up to her for Canadians. Like she's like our idol, you know.
Right.
And just knowing she came from a small town and seeing her success made me believe I could do it too. So it's transferable. It's not even just that's in cool. your sport, but like anyone. But I think there's something about being where you come from really shows you that you can do it. And, you know, we see it in Canadian tennis today. Canadian tennis has come such a long way in the last 10 years. And when I grew up, like we didn't have that many people to look up to.
Yeah.
And now there are so many and you know, after I started having success, I'm getting calls from my old coaches back in Canada, like, our tennis camps are full, like our tournament rosters are exploding. And you're just like, wow, to have been like a piece of that is just an honor, first of all. And it just makes me so happy because, like, you know, something I love, so many other people love now. And it's just like such a cool feeling.
That's so dang cool. I'm going to shout out one other Canadian athlete. Joey Votto played for the Reds for 12, 13 years. I worked with him for 5. Great guy, but also super proud to be from Canada and had success in Major League Baseball, the biggest stage. Sorry, I know we're going over on time. Let me get
No worries at all.
Oh, okay. We'll just stay here and talk for 4 hours.
I got nothing else to do today.
This will be a real therapy session then. Okay.
Dual, both sides. We'll both be getting...
Okay, like, well, go ahead. What baggage you want to know from me? I got a ton of it.
We'll both just be like opening up and also helping the other deal with our therapy issues.
You know what's funny about that is Oh, did you ever watch the show Love is Blind?
Yes. Wasn't that during... COVID?
Yes. So do you know, remember Deep D from Love is Blind?
No.
No, it's okay. But she was like probably the most popular one from Love is Blind. Okay. We became friends afterwards, but like I just met her, we did the interview like this. And then I don't think I've ever told the story, but like after the interview, we sat there for like an hour and we're like breaking down each other's relationships that like brought us to this point. And it was just funny, like, oh, I just watched your whole relationship on Netflix and now we're going to talk about it. And you care to talk about mine. Like, again, now we, you know, become friends and we're doing events together. So like, it's totally different, but like, yeah, I just thought that was funny after you brought that up.
No, it's fun to meet people that can just relate. Again, is that word?
It's the relatability.
Relating. Like humans, we are social beings, right?
Yeah.
So we want to be able to feel connected. We want to feel that community. And so it's like, if you're going through something that makes me remember something I went through, that like just makes me feel good. And it's like, well, something you can talk about with someone. And I just think that's important.
Amen. And I'm going to end it on that after one more question, because I think that's great advice. And that's what I ask about always at the end. Advice to somebody that might be a young tennis player that's putting in all that work, putting in all the time, and has the same dreams that that you did, do, and are still living. What would you tell that young girl that wants to chase the tennis dreams?
Well, I would say many things. But firstly, I would say a quote I always go back to is dream big, work hard. So you have to first have the vision, because you need the path to know where to go, right? So you need to have clearly defined dreams and goals. Then work hard. There's no way around the hard work.
Nope.
Like we were talking about, you have to sacrifice. You have to think of it as, okay, you can't compare yourself to your normal friends. Like I'm trying to achieve something special. So I have to do something special. So I have to skip that party and I have to skip this and that and sacrifice. And you have to just like accept that sacrifice, I would say. And then the third thing I would say is just, you know, don't worry about what anyone else around you says. It's keep in mind, of course, your family, your friends, your close friends, coaches, you know, the important people, but everything else, just let it be white noise in the background, because they don't actually really care about you. So you shouldn't really care about them.
God, so,
you know,
1000%.
And so I've just learned through the years. It's like, and you know what? Those people who are maybe your position, reporters and things like that, maybe they have an ulterior motive. Like they need to write a sensational story. They need a clickbait headline. Yeah. So you know what? It's actually not even personal. They are literally just using you. You're the vehicle to get them to have a cool article that people want to click on. And so when you like release that like personal, like, you know, I'm not like insulted personally by this or anything, then you realize, okay, it's just their job. I'm doing my job. They do their job. Don't worry about all that noise and don't let it infiltrate in your mind, because you have to believe in yourself. If you don't believe in yourself, no one else will. So you have to do it first and then the rest will follow.
Amazing answer, except for I think that was a personal attack at me and my profession.
So I hate reporters. No,
yeah, it's okay. I can get through it. That's my old job. I don't do that anymore. Jeannie, thank you so much for coming on The Mental Game and opening
up.
Really appreciate it. We are not playing pickleball after this, but maybe next time you're in LA, I'll be living here. I need to learn how to play, and then I'll take you down in ping pong. You beat me in pickleball.
Okay.
I'll
show you the ropes.
Thank you. We're not playing tennis.
I'll be nice. Okay. Yeah. No tennis. We'll do some easy ping. You show me the ropes in ping pong. I'll show you the ropes in pickleball. And yeah, let me know when you're back in LA.
All right. Sounds good. Thank you so much. And we'll see everybody right back here next week on The Mental Game. And I love that interview with Jeannie. She was so fun to talk to about her tennis career. And now as she's playing pickleball professionally, don't worry, she's playing both tennis and pickleball at the same time. But I really appreciate her opening up about her struggles on and off the court, her mental health, and now how she's taking better care of herself through therapy, sports psychology, and a lot of other healthy coping mechanisms that I think we all can learn from listening to this episode. Next week, it is another surprise guest, but we are going back to the NFL next week here on The Mental Game.